From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And where are we on the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination? Well, the FBI report into allegations of sexual assault by Kavanaugh may come out as soon as today. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has vowed that it will be seen by senators only, but other Republicans want to make it public. And there's been lots of reaction to President Trump's words last night. Last week, he said he found Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, credible. But at a rally in Mississippi, he mocked her recollections of what she said was a sexual assault by Kavanaugh in high school.
36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know.
The president went on to make some false claims about Blasey Ford's testimony, and sex abuse counselors say it's common for survivors to have spotty memories. But last night, Trump and yesterday his son Don echoed a theme being expressed by conservative commentators that it's now a scary time for young men, implying they might be falsely accused. Let's bring in NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. Kelsey, what kind of response are you hearing to the president's comments?
Well, so far, senators are just now starting to pour into the Capitol for the day. There have been people staked out outside of many senators' offices. But I think the one that is most pressing and most important is Senator Susan Collins of Maine. She's a Republican, and she is undecided so far on Kavanaugh. And she told reporters waiting outside of her office that the president's comments were just plain wrong. And we also heard from Senator Jeff Flake, who was on the Today Show today, and he called it appalling.
Well, let's listen to a little of Senator Flake, who, in fact, had said he'd vote for Kavanaugh, but then called for the FBI investigation, kind of started this whole dramatic chapter this last week. Let's listen to him on Today Show.
There's no time and no place for remarks like that, but to discuss something this sensitive at a political rally is just... It's just not right. I wish he hadn't have done it. It's kind of appalling.
So we hear those remarks from him and from Susan Collins, both of them seen as potential swing votes, people who might vote against Kavanaugh's nomination. Are you getting the sense that, you know, maybe the president's comments are doing more than just making people feel appalled? Are they maybe pushing votes one way or another?
It'll be hard to say until the FBI report is released. The FBI is in the process of completing a supplemental background check into Kavanaugh based on the allegations from Ford and from other accusers. Many of these people who are undecided say that they are not going to make up their minds until they see what is in that report.
Right. And as we said, it might come out today, but Mitch McConnell wants to keep it confidential to senators. Other senators like Bob Corker and John Cornyn want it made public. What's their reasoning?
I spoke with both of them yesterday, and part of what they said is that there is a concern that if it is not released in some way, that selective leaks essentially could happen, and that those leaks could be in furthering individual political aims. And that Corker in particular said that he thought that if the public was able to see the entirety of the report, then it would be harder for people to impugn whatever outcomes happen as a result of that report.
Well, tying into that, are any Republicans speaking out against Mitch McConnell's plan to have the vote this week in the next couple of days? When people haven't had a chance to digest that report, and as you said, maybe parts of it might leak out after the report, after the vote, rather, and kind of reflect poorly on people's votes if some of it leaks. Is anyone asking him to wait?
Not that we're aware of. At this point, he has said, and he was very, very blunt about this in his press conference yesterday, that it is up to him when to schedule a vote. Now, it couldn't change. He could decide that that is not in his best interest if it looks like maybe there aren't the votes there. But he seems to be quite confident that they are moving in the direction of being able to confirm Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to see any scenario in which McConnell changes his mind.
Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional reporter, just quickly, what's it like there in the halls of Congress?
It is tense. There's a hugely increased police presence, and there are protesters just about everywhere you go. I've been covering the Capitol for about 8.5 years, and this might be the most tense I've seen it.
Oh, truly. Kelsey, thank you.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has been busy rolling back key environmental rules. In just the past few days, there have been new plans to weaken regulations on mercury emissions and on radiation exposure. Let's bring in Timothy Kama. He's an energy and environment reporter at The Hill. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Let's start with this news about the EPA's plan to loosen regulations on radiation exposure. What do we know about that?
So this was sort of a fold in a regulation that EPA did in April, proposed to sort of change how they evaluate whether something is scientifically sound. They're proposing to potentially look at the models that they use for evaluating the risk of exposure to various things like radiation or other cancerous substances. Currently and previously, EPA kind of assumed that any amount of radiation or, you know, similar cancerous substances can be dangerous. You know, even if it's just one in a million risk of cancer, it's something that can be quantified. Now, this regulation didn't specifically mention radiation, but nonetheless, it could have an impact in terms of, you know, evaluating exposure from contaminated Superfund sites or population-level exposures to things like radiation.
So who could it affect? I'm thinking, you know, there's people at nuclear facilities, oil and gas drilling rigs, technicians who are giving you an X-ray at the dentist's office, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And again, since this particular regulation doesn't mention radiation, it wouldn't be an immediate thing when this regulation is finalized. But, you know, when they're conducting those scientific research and looking at the data for something like people who live near sites with a lot of radiation, this has the potential to change how EPA is going to evaluate that.
Okay. Over the last couple of days, we're also hearing that the Trump administration is trying to make changes that would weaken regulation on mercury. What would that mean?
Right. So they're looking back at a 2011 major regulation from the Obama administration that really was responsible for shutting down a lot of coal-fired power plants. They're not actually looking at this point at changing that regulation. They're looking at changing the cost-benefit analysis behind it. The Obama administration estimated that this regulation would cost $9.6 billion, but with health benefits about 10 times that. To the Trump administration, they don't believe that a lot of the pollutants that were used to come to that benefit figure should really be counted and that, you know, only mercury should be counted.
So I want to make sure that I'm clear here. The change that we're talking about would not allow the EPA to consider the health benefits of reducing pollution. That's something that the industry calls co-benefits, right?
Exactly. Well, you know, this current administration, they believe that the directly regulated substances, in this case mercury and some other toxic air pollutants, the benefits from this regulation to reducing those should be considered. But when you shut down coal-fired power plants, you also reduce particulate matter, nitrogen oxides, other things that really have a big public health impact. And this administration doesn't believe those should be considered. So when you change that cost-benefit analysis, it really has the potential down the road to either prevent this regulation from getting stronger or potentially even to repeal it in the future.
There is a tie here, as there is the last couple of days on many stories in the news, to Brett Kavanaugh. In 2014, the coal industry sued to roll back this mercury regulation, and it lost in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. But Judge Kavanaugh, who serves on that court, wrote the dissenting opinion, and he argued that the mercury rule was too expensive for the coal industry. So if Kavanaugh is confirmed to the Supreme Court, he could be ruling on this case if it goes that far.
Exactly. You know, and his whole record on the D.C. Circuit has been somewhat skeptical of high-cost regulations. He specifically looked at co-benefits, the pollutants that happen to be reduced from a regulation. And yeah, he didn't believe that those should be counted, which would have made it a not cost-effective regulation.
So those are two major rule changes that the Trump administration is considering, but there are many more. I'm seeing the industry is getting a big win on a methane rollback, potentially. What else are you watching here?
Yeah, so the administration is on sort of a big regulatory rollback streak in these last couple months. EPA is working on repealing Obama administration standards to reduce methane emissions from oil and natural gas drilling. That's a potent greenhouse gas. But in so many corners of this administration on environmental policy, there are rollbacks coming. You know, the Clean Power Plan, limiting carbon dioxide pollution from power plants, the Clean Water Rule, you know, so many other regulations left and right that in these last couple months are moving towards either repeal or a significant rollback.
And Tim, who's behind all of this? Because I'm sure that this is exactly what industry wants to see.
Right. A lot of these changes are driven by industry, either because of previous litigation or lobbying or what have you. For example, Murray Energy is one of the biggest coal mining companies in the United States. Its chief executive, Bob Murray, is a strong supporter of President Trump. The current acting administrator at EPA, Andrew Wheeler, used to lobby for Murray Energy, but also a lot of industry groups, National Mining Association, American Petroleum Institute, and the like. They're largely behind a lot of this. But there are also things that the Republican Party and that the Trump administration have supported for a while.
Timothy Gamma, energy and environment reporter at The Hill. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us about this. We do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Years ago, Beijing vowed to put an end to the Made in China label that was being equated with cheap knockoffs. It's since spent billions of dollars on acquiring advanced technologies in countries with the brand name recognition China lacks, places like Germany. At first, Germans welcomed the Chinese investment into their recession-battered business sector, but now the German government is scrambling to curb Chinese control. NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson begins her report, part of an NPR series on China's growing influence around the world, in Germany's Rust Belt, at a transportation hub the Chinese are using to spread their economic influence.
Welcome to Logport, the end of what is referred to as the New Silk Road. Each week, 25 trains traveling 6,000 miles from China rumble into this hub in the western German city of Duisburg. They are packed with consumer goods like clothes and electronics. Giant cranes unload the metal containers from the trains and stack them. The towering rows stretch as far as the eye can see, but never stay around for long. They are loaded onto tractor trailers, which deliver the contents across the European Union. But the New Silk Road isn't exactly a two-way street. The trains are a lot emptier when they head back to China, says Erich Stacke. He's the German CEO of Duisport, the world's largest inland port, of which Logport is a part.
In the first years, four containers came in, one went back.
Stacke says the ratio is improving. These days, two-thirds of what the trains carry are Chinese imports, while the remaining third are European exports headed to China. But it's more than the lopsided trade relationship that has the Germans on their guard. The Chinese are snapping up firms in fields that Germany dominates, like engineering. The fear is China, as part of its ambitious Made in China 2025 strategy, is trying to dominate key industries, including robotics, electric vehicles, and solar technology. The takeover spiked here in Germany in 2016, with Chinese investors buying 68 German companies. Another 57 were bought last year. Dagmar Schmidt chairs the China-Germany Economy Committee in the German parliament.
When you realize there's a political interest in investments, then you need to look at those very closely.
Her government tightened controls on foreign takeovers last year, allowing Berlin to veto deals in which at least 25% of a business is at stake. Cora Jungblut is an economics expert at the Bertelsmann Foundation, who did a recent study on China's shopping spree in Germany.
What I suggested in the study is to lower the threshold from 25% to 10%. So it would make sense to say, okay, as soon as an investor from abroad acquires 10% in the shares of a German company in these sectors, like critical infrastructure, national security, because the investor appears to have a controlling interest in this company.
It's something the German economy minister is reported to be considering. The decision to put on the brakes on foreign investment was in part sparked by the Chinese firm Midea's purchase in 2016 of KUKA, a global leader in robotics located in the southern German city of Augsburg. But predictions the Chinese would shut down the company, eliminate jobs, and transfer its operations and technologies east proved unfounded, at least for now, says Michael Lepek, the director of the Augsburg chapter of the trade union IG Metall.
In the past, they copied a lot, but now they think they see that this is not enough. I think they are very interesting in our DNA to understand how we develop things, how we engineer things, how we construct things, not only to produce something.
He says the Chinese agreed to keep KUKA open and its jobs safe until 2023. Lippick says it was a different story for another Augsburg-based company, Ledvance, which has 650 employees and produces light bulbs sold in 120 countries, including the U.S. He says the Chinese firm MLS bought the company last year and is now shutting it down.
They bought it, I would say, because of the brand name. They bought it because they saw the figures and they said, well, it looks nice and we can do something with it. And after they bought it, it just goes down and down and down.
But Ledvance workers who spoke to NPR do not blame the Chinese for the impending closure. They criticize German companies and the German government for failing to keep Ledvance competitive. One of the Ledvance workers said he does have reservations about the Chinese buying more of Germany's top companies. He mentioned Daimler AG. Earlier this year, a Chinese magnate bought a $9 billion stake in the German maker of Mercedes cars and trucks. The Ledvance worker asked that we not identify him for fear of being fired and having his severance pay that is still being negotiated taken away. Daimler is a very important employer in Germany and affects our reputation around the world. Is what happened at Ledvance going to happen there next? To the north in Cologne, the mood is a lot more upbeat at the pharmaceutical technology company Romico. The firm, which employs about 500 people at three German locations and one Italian one, builds machines used to make pills and capsules. The machines are sold worldwide. Romico was purchased by the Chinese firm Truking last July. Not that you would know it looking around the factory floor. There's no sign of the new Chinese owners, nor does the Truking logo appear on Romico products. CEO Jörg Pieper says his new employer recognizes that customers will pay up to 25% more for a Romico product, which they associate with German engineering and high quality, than a Truking one, which is a Chinese newcomer to the pharmaceutical technology field.
Many Germans still have a kind of a view about China from 25 years ago. And absolutely, yes. There you had a lot of copies. You had, for the very few cases where you had Chinese ownership, there was quite often technology transfer, and then the European companies were closed. You don't see that in the last couple of years anymore because China has matured to a very large extent.
He believes German fears about the Chinese are largely unfounded, just like American ones about Japanese investors were in the 1980s when they bought up U.S. enterprises.
Reality will always be very different. And if you look where and how Japanese companies stand today in relation to the U.S. economy, it is a normal part of the business.
Pieper predicts Germans will eventually feel the same way about Chinese investors and companies in Germany. Soraya Sirhadi Nelson, NPR News.
People in Phoenix and other parts of Arizona are drying out today after record rainfall yesterday. The remnants of Hurricane Rosa, now a tropical depression, dropped close to 2.5 inches of rain on the Phoenix metro area. That is a lot of rain anywhere, but for Phoenix, it was the city's wettest October day ever and one of the wettest days in the city's history, period. Joining us now is Ian Schwartz. He's a meteorologist at KPHO CBS5 there in Phoenix. Ian, welcome.
Thanks for having me. We're drying out a little bit.
It sounds like it. And how significant was that rainfall? Because if you do the math, that means that Phoenix got several months' worth of rain in a single day.
Yeah, and that a lot of that was in 12 hours. We got about a third of the rain we would see in an entire year in about 12 hours.
Wow. Is it common for a hurricane, the remnants of a hurricane in the Pacific, to make it that far up north into the desert?
Yeah, we'll see this happen every couple, 3-4 years. And when it does, it's something we watch very closely. Not so much for the hurricane to roll into town and, you know, the classic thing you would see on the East Coast with the wind, but it sends a tremendous amount of moisture our way, and it helped just become a very efficient rain-producing system. And it rained for, 10 hours straight. It's not something we see often here. We're used to kind of hit-and-miss storms, or one side of Phoenix will get pummeled and the other side sees nothing.
Huh.
But this was just a steady stream that did not stop.
And because of that, there was flooding. The pictures of some of the flash floods were pretty amazing. Dramatic car rescues as well. Here's one driver, Daniela Prieto, speaking to one of your reporters at CBS 5. She had to be rescued from firefighters when her car got stuck in a wash.
I was panicking. I didn't know what to do because the water started coming into the car. Finally, the firefighters were able to come and get us out of the car. We had to climb through the windows.
Ian, why are people driving through flooded washes?
Well, they shouldn't be. Sometimes it is driver error. They think they can make it. Their car doesn't have high enough clearance, and they get stranded. The engine floods out. Other times, the water actually comes so fast that people don't realize what's happening, and before they know it, their car is stalled out and they're in a real pickle. So many, many times, yes, it is someone doing something they're not supposed to, but there are instances where the water can move that fast where all of a sudden it's rising and then the engine stops and you have to be rescued. And that particular situation, the lady, there must have been a drainage issue. Sometimes we'll get the drains get clogged or a pump will malfunction on a certain road or interstate, and then all of a sudden you see water will be, you know, almost halfway up a giant fire truck's tire. And some of the images, you can see how far that water was. So it's hard to say if it was that woman's fault or if it's not, but it can be a mixed bag sometime.
All right. Ian Schwartz, meteorologist for KPHO CBS 5 in Phoenix, which just got dumped on from the remnants of Hurricane Rosa. Ian, thanks very much.
Appreciate it.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The battle over Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court is being waged not only in the nation's capital, but on the national airwaves as well. Advocates on both sides are spending millions of dollars on advertising campaigns, and Here and Now media analyst John Carroll has been paying attention. John, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
How about we start with the pro-Kavanaugh side? Who's leading that charge?
Well, the most dominant group is a conservative group called the Judicial Crisis Network. They've spent overall about $12 million supporting the Kavanaugh nomination. Right now, they have a $2 million ad campaign out on cable and broadcast television, and the spot features some of Kavanaugh's longtime female friends vouching for him and denouncing what they call the smear campaign against him.
Okay, let's listen to some of that.
The girls who were his closest friends in high school had no choice but to stand up and say, "That's not the Brett I know."
Brett Kavanaugh is a good man who is incapable of mistreating anyone.
Okay, and some of his friends from the past are now also saying the exact opposite thing. But, you know, there are other groups that are supporting Kavanaugh but taking a different approach by attacking Democrats.
Right. One of those groups is a conservative group called Citizens United. They have an ad claiming that liberal Democrats will stop at nothing to smear Kavanaugh. And then the ad goes on to pretty much smear three Democratic senators.
Mm-hmm.
That's a $250,000 ad buy. And there are several other campaigns out there, pro-Kavanaugh ad campaigns as well.
Okay. There's a two-pronged strategy on the Stop Kavanaugh side. Here's part of a TV spot from the liberal group Demand Justice. It features Christine Blasey Ford's Senate testimony.
My name is Christine Blasey Ford. I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. The details about that night that bring me here today are the ones I will never forget.
Yeah, this ad cuts back and forth between Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony and young women watching her testimony on various digital devices. It ends with a super on the screen, white type on a black background, says, "We believe survivors." The ad buy is kind of modest, $120,000 on cable channels in Washington, D.C., and up in Alaska and Maine as well. There's a lot of that kind of targeting of particular senators who are going to be key in this vote.
Right. The ACLU. Now, this is interesting. Not usually in the mix in this type of a political fight, but this time, yes.
Right. They normally do not endorse candidates for political or judicial office. This is only the fourth time they've done it in 98 years.
Huh.
They have a million-dollar ad campaign in a number of different states associating Kavanaugh with Bill Clinton, Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose. It's a really tough ad.
And some of the groups that are involved in these ads, they're nonprofits, which means what? That we don't exactly know who's got the money behind them?
Right. These are what are called 501c4 nonprofit organizations. They're supposed to be basically advocating for social change. But what's happening is they're using their money, which we don't know where it comes from. They don't have to disclose their donors.
Yeah.
So really, they're in many ways, they're kind of stealth players. So Citizens United, Judicial Crisis Network, Demand Justice, all of those are what are known as dark money organizations.
This is the way that American politics works today.
Right. And it's they're basically stealth players in this really high-stakes game.
All right. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. We've got a link to his campaign outsider blog at hereandnow.org. John, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here's something we found interesting. We've just read two new terrific novels, and they both feature the fascination in 18th century England with mermaids, or the corpses of what were said to be mermaids, to be accurate, displayed in museums or at parties. It was a real craze, if, of course, not a real mermaid, sometimes the corpse of a monkey with a tail sewn on. But anyway, mermaids are at the heart of Imogen Hermes Gower's debut novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. There's a rather dull widower merchant, Jonah Hancock. His ship comes in. Literally, one of his captains brings him the corpse of a mermaid, which people soon pay to see because it has the same siren-like attraction another character has. This is the courtesan, Angelica Neal. Do not call her a whore. She was once kept by a wealthy man but has fallen on hard times. The book is ultimately about class and gender and race and mermaids. It was a bestseller in the UK, shortlisted for the 2018 Women's Prize for Fiction, recently released in the U.S. And Imogen Hermes Gower joins us from the BBC studios in Bristol. Welcome. Come.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What a delight. And by the way, the other book that mentions a mermaid is Daniel Mason's new Winter Soldier. In it, there's a doctor soldier around the same time who, with other scientists, studies a mermaid that's in a museum. A young Madame Curie, Marie Curie, even shows up in the scene to determine if this is a real mermaid. This was a real craze.
Yeah, it really was. I think mermaids were being exhibited kind of throughout the 18th century. There's loads of newspaper articles and reports and drawings of them and things. People were really into them and wanted them to exist, I guess.
And tell us about that. Why did they want them to exist? We know that these were sailors who were coming home in 16th, 17th, 18th centuries with talks of seeing these mermaids out in the water. They think now that it might have been optical illusions. But why did people want so badly to believe that they existed?
It's kind of a way of populating the void. Like, back then, the greatest kind of expanse that you could explore is the ocean, and you kind of want there to be humanoid creatures or something recognisable in it. So I think, you know, mermaids are an easy answer to that, but I guess nowadays maybe that's slightly replaced by aliens in space.
Yes.
That the unexplored is out there now rather than in the sea, and
right.
we look for humans there too.
Yeah. Well, and you were first inspired by what may have been the same mermaid mentioned in Daniel Mason's book. I mean, it really did exist, the Fiji mermaid?
Yeah. There's a whole kind of tradition of Fiji mermaids. So the one that I was inspired by is in the British Museum, and I worked there for a while, and it was there that I saw it in the collection and kind of my brain started turning. But I know P.T. Barnum had one that had originally started out being exhibited in coffee houses in London as well. And I know that there are two in regional museums in the UK that were made as a pair, as a male and a female, and they're being reunited this year, I think, in some special exhibition.
And it's not what one would imagine. These were ugly critters because of the way they were actually faked and put together. But can you have a description of the one that you write about? Could you read a little bit of that for us so we get a sense of what people were gawking at?
Sure. Captain Jones eases the canvas away, and at first they cannot think what it is they see. for it is brown and wizened like an apple forgotten at the bottom of the barrel, or like the long-dead rats Mr. Hancock once found bricked up in the kitchen wall, parched and cured by the elements, skin that cracked under the pressure of a thumb. It's the size of an infant, and like an infant, its ribcage is delicate and pathetic beneath its parchment skin, and its head is large and its fists are drawn up to its face. But this is as far as the comparison may be extended. For no infant has such fearful claws, and no infant such a snarl with such sharp fangs in it, and no infant's torso ends in the tail of a fish.
It's just a horror, but one that people can't take their eyes off of. And as you've said, it becomes the MacGuffin for you, the object that kind of draws us into this story. You know, this is your debut fiction, but you come to writing through an academic background and working in museums and a student of archaeology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So my undergrad, I studied archaeology and anthropology and art history. So I definitely kind of came in from this angle of looking at objects and trying to understand how they could shed light on people's stories, what place they take in people's lives.
Give us some examples of that and how you put that in the book.
I think maybe it manifests quite a lot, I have subsequently been told, in the clothes that people wear, especially the women's clothes, that I really felt that someone like Angelica Neal, this courtesan main character of mine, I studied a lot of 18th century dress to kind of try and understand her, how she would feel in her clothes, this idea that, like, you might unpick the adornments from one dress, all the lace and chenille, and attach it to another one, whether you'd allow your stockings to get holes in them or whether you'd always wear new ones, whether you'd let your corset in and out, your stays in and out as you gained weight or lost it, and do you give your second-hand dresses to your servants, that kind of thing, like, it says something about a person and what their values are and how they live, and I really felt that Angelica expressed herself through her clothing. So that was certainly one of the things.
Well, you treat objects the way you were taught when you worked in museums and studied art history. You were taught not to look at the oil painting directly, but look around it. What's the frame made of? And it sounds like that's how you are approaching your writing. And it feels like this was something that was born when you were a child. And there was another, you know, kind of oddity. Is it Ötzi? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, yeah. Ötzi. That was my first love. Ötzi, the 5,000-year-old mummified corpse that was dug out of a glacier in about 1991, I think. And they must have made a TV documentary about it when I was quite, I would say, between the age of 5 and 7. And I remember watching it and just being completely transfixed and drawing pictures of him over and over. He was a shepherd up in the mountains, and he had with him everything that he needed to live. So he had, like, this quiver of arrows, and he had straw stuffed into his boots to keep his feet warm, and he'd mended his cloak himself. They could tell that he was up there in the mountains for a long time, and he had to be very self-sufficient until he got back to the village and someone else would, you know, fix his stuff and give him new boots. That physical understanding of what it might be like to have been that person in the past, to understand all these tiny details of their life and, I guess, the ephemera of it. That's, I guess, always what I've been interested in. What's the texture of living in that world? You read about armies and battles and laws being passed, but who is it who's bringing in the food or making up the beds? Do these people miss their children? That kind of stuff was what I was always interested in. And I guess there's more space for that in fiction than there is in, say, archaeology, when you do have to be very rigorous and strict with yourself and quite detective-like. That there is, in fiction, this space to play and to imagine.
Well, so this is what happens when an anthropologist takes on fiction, because that's how we feel about the characters. We have all these details about how they do things, how they eat, what their tea sets look like. And that brings us back to Angelica. Again, a courtesan, not, you know, she you know, completely disdains the women of the street. She is not that. But what are you saying about women? There's a brothel with many young women who are sort of being instructed to grow up to be Angelica. What are you saying about what you've discovered in history about women's positions in this time?
I think the more that I researched the book and the more I thought about what is the story here, I kind of realized that what I was doing was, in my mind, I guess, almost a kind of survey of the options for 18th century women. It's very much a world without feminism, where if women try to do well by themselves, it might be at the expense of other women. There is very little sense of solidarity. you kind of pull the ladder up. Like, if you've done okay, you want to continue to protect yourself. And the way you protect yourself is by appealing to men who will protect you in this system that has no structure to protect you on your own as a lone woman. The idea of, I guess, morality and sexual fidelity and that kind of thing becomes actually quite a privileged thing to be able to indulge in. That to be a good person means you are in some way already protected, that you don't have to become a whore or a thief. Mm. You don't have to make those choices because you're not supporting yourself alone. It made me more sympathetic to these women who I think history very easily dismisses as total floozies, that actually they had very little to fall back on except for their bodies and their attractiveness. And, of course, they were using those things.
Just like the mermaids did.
Yeah.
That's Imogen Hermes Gower. Her new book, set in late 18th century England, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. Imogen, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. That was great.
To read an excerpt of The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, or to see pictures of the Fiji mermaid and Imogen's childhood love, Utsi, the mummy in the glacier, as she said, yes, it's glacier, go to hereandnow.org.
It's Here and Now, and an update on another disaster that has struck Indonesia and the island of Sulawesi. Days after an earthquake and tsunami killed more than 1,400 people in Palu, Indonesia, a volcano has erupted. Mount Soputan is on the northern tip of Sulawesi. It's about 350 miles away from the city of Palu. A government scientist said it is possible the eruption was triggered by the earthquake. Researchers have been noticing increased activity inside the mountain since July. Now, the good news is that the ash from the volcano is blowing away from Palu, and right now it is not affecting any relief flights coming into the city. Facial recognition technology is beginning to replace passwords on smartphones, and it's also inching into public spaces, including schools. That has brought up a number of concerns. Carolyn Adolph of member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
The first thing you see when you arrive at the Seattle headquarters of internet streaming giant Real Networks isn't the receptionist. It's the screen that's looking for your face before the receptionist sees you coming.
So the first thing you have to do is get your face into the system.
That's Mike Vance of Real Networks, and this is his baby. It's called SAFER, Secure Accurate Facial Recognition.
So you just hit tap to start.
I can see a tight little circle grab hold of my face.
Yeah, just hit tap in the purple circle.
Okay.
There you go.
And then I'm registered.
And I see it's hunting for my face now that it knows.
Right.
Now every step I take here will be monitored by a machine that knows my name and knows that I'm not allowed to open any doors.
This is a request to register. This gets sent off to the school administration, and there's a final approval.
SAFER is a product Real Networks designed to improve school safety.
And this is really useful even in small schools where there's somebody at the front desk that knows everybody.
People with access can smile into a screen and open a door. Because people at the front desk aren't always there, SAFER can also take action if it sees someone denied access. It can alert security or call the police. SAFER is installed at a private elementary school in Seattle. Right now, according to Real Networks, no one is being forced to use it. Not so in New York State, where the Lockport School District is installing a network of cameras called Aegis. It is constantly looking at all the faces inside schools, watching for known criminals and kids who have been expelled or suspended, and also watching for weapons.
The system was pitched to the district as a way to keep bad people out of the building.
Jim Schultz is a parent of a sophomore at Lockport High School who has concerns about the system.
What nobody admitted until the very end was that this is going to be a set of 300 cameras that are going to be constantly filming the students and the teachers in the halls in every school in the district.
Schultz says he worries about how the data collected from all those cameras could potentially be used.
They can literally go back and create a map of who hung out with who in the halls, of who speaks to who, and you know, that is a whole other kind of surveillance. It could be used for all kinds of things, and it's just a violation of privacy that no one talked to parents about.
The Lockport School District says it hasn't yet decided what rules it will attach to the use of its new network of facial recognition cameras. Digital life is now full of examples where data taken for one reason is used later for a completely different reason.
And the extreme example of this is in China, where schools are heavily monitored and all of this information and data goes into a record of that student that not only is for disciplinary purposes in the school, but actually follows them around for the rest of their lives.
This is Shankar Narayan of the American Civil Liberties Union in Seattle.
Now, we may say that's China, it would never happen here, but we are building a surveillance infrastructure that would certainly enable that.
But the technology behind it may not be as accurate as tech firms suggest. The ACLU fed photos of members of Congress into an Amazon facial recognition product called Recognition, with a K. 28 were matched incorrectly to mugshot photos. Meanwhile, some Amazon employees have asked the company not to sell Recognition to the Trump administration, fearing the technology could end up being used by immigration enforcement.
So many times, there is mission creep. A system that's adopted for one purpose, down the line is used for another purpose and another purpose.
Back in Seattle, Mike Vance says Real Networks thought about allowing SAFER to record students' every move.
We debate, are there positive uses for this data and are there negative uses for this data?
The decision was not to use the technology for surveillance.
So you would know which students are on which camera, and that's about as far as you can go with it.
And that decision is part of the reason why the ACLU's Shankar Narayan says he's hopeful. The more people live with and work with facial recognition technology, he says, the more they will begin to define the values that they want to see respected. For Here and Now, I'm Carolyn Adolph in Seattle.
And Eileen Buckley from WBFO in Buffalo contributed to Carolyn's story. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.